Hi, and welcome to the FASD Elephant Podcast, the only podcast devoted to better understanding and treating fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. If you care for or work with a child or adult who has FASD, then this podcast is for you. All right. Hi, this is Michael Harris from the FASD Elephant Podcast and blog. This is being recorded on what's called in the United States Black Friday. It's the day after our holiday Thanksgiving. And so I know that caregivers have been experiencing probably a lot of stress from the holidays and school being out. I know I have. So just able to take a break here this morning, and I have on my Skype line here Linda Rosenbaum, and she and I have been trying to set this interview up for quite some time. She's just released a book. I really want to talk to her about that and get her perspective on being a caregiver from FASD. All right. So, Linda, just wanted to welcome you to the podcast. And I know you've been doing some interviews here the past few weeks since your book launch. And I was wanted to welcome you, and I'm really appreciative. I was wanted to mention you and I, we've tried to set this interview up several times, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with you. So how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, Michael, and thank you very much for this opportunity. I've been following your work through your website and tweets and so on, so it's nice to make contact with you, and I appreciate this.
Absolutely. I think that's how we first met, was becoming Twitter pals or on LinkedIn or something, and the social media is just amazing for Yeah, exactly. So, I was hoping you could take just a moment and introduce yourself to our audience and let them know who you are and what you do and what you would like for us to know about that.
Sure. First of all, I live in Toronto, and besides other things, I'm the mother of two adopted children, Michael, who's now 27, and a daughter, Sarah, 25. We adopted both of the children at birth, and Michael, adopted at birth, was diagnosed 6 years later with what was then called fetal alcohol syndrome at our major hospital here called the Hospital for Sick Children. And that's been a very big part of my life. Professionally, I'm a writer and an editor and have a degree in public health, so I've worked within the public health system as well. And now I try to be an advocate for children with special needs, and as we all know, there's lots of work to be done in that department.
Yes, so there's a lot of work in that area. Are you mostly doing that through your book and writing, or are you giving talks? So what is some of the advocacy work that you're working on right now?
Yeah, well, I am going to speak at support groups, and we have a large institute, a mental health facility here at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. I've done some videos for them from a caregiver's perspective, what I wish professionals had known while we were raising Michael. And I have a big, long list of what I wished for. Right. So I think it's because of the book that I just published about our life raising Michael. I think because of that, I'm getting a lot of opportunity to speak to groups. And I think people are really interested. As we know, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder still is underdiagnosed, misdiagnosed, and misunderstood. So any chance I have to talk about it from a caregiver's perspective, I'm really happy about that.
Absolutely. Well, it's just terrific that you're able to do that. Now, I'm also a caregiver, and I'm looking, and I downloaded your book onto my Nook, so folks can get it in paper or in electronic. And I toy with writing sometimes, and just finding the time to do it. And I know that that's part of your professional job, but so one of my questions is, how long did it take you to write this book, and where do you find the time? And this is like an honest question from a caregiver perspective. Where do you find the time to write in a way that really resonates with caregivers. As I was reading it, there were several times when I'm like, oh, I recognize that, or oh, I bet I know what's coming. And so it was really kind of matching some of my experiences, and I bet that'll happen with other caregivers. So getting that feeling into your writing, how do you take the time to do that? What is your process?
It is such a good question, and to be really honest with you, I would say the book took up to 10 years to write. I didn't have the time. You know, I would just take moments of time here and there, but to really tap into my own voice and to be honest about what I was feeling, that took work and it took time. It was also painful to write. There were yes. chapters in my family's life I found very painful to revisit. So I had a choice. Do I really write honestly what it feels like when my son is failing all over the place, or I can't take anymore, or when we have marital problems because my husband feels one way about what to do with Michael and I feel another way.
Yeah.
I had a choice. Do I really write honestly, which, you know, really was, sometimes I doubted myself that sure. I really wanted to do that. But anyways, to get that voice and to write honestly, it was hard. And sometimes I would push it all back down and not want to write. In the end, I thought, like you said, that it was really important for other caregivers to know that what they're feeling is they are not alone. I don't want people to feel as isolated as I did it sometimes. Other people are feeling the same thing that they're feeling. And, you know, yes. there's joy in there, too, and that we do experience joy. But there's more than just the joy. And there's a struggle. So to write about the struggles were hard, but I felt it was essential to include them. And as I say, it took time. I was lucky I had editors who really helped me and encouraged me. There were many times I put the book down and I would say to my husband, I'm done. I've had it. I'm not doing this.
Right.
But I kept on. I thought it was important to do. I just want to say one more thing.
Sure.
I really wanted to write a book that healthcare and social service professionals would read so they got a sense of what our day-to-day lives are like. I think many of them, you know, are so well-meaning, but the truth is they spend 15 minutes with our kids.
Yes.
And, you know, other than teachers who really do spend full days with our kids, they don't really know what it's like. And a lot of people are dishing out advice or saying, do this or do that. As again, I say well-meaning, but they don't really know what it's like. And I think it would be really helpful for them to know what we go through and what we need.
I couldn't agree with you more. I was having a conversation with a family member yesterday and trying to explain, because I've been trying to plan a little getaway, you know, this weekend coming up. And it's just, it's become a challenge. And, right, and there's advice that we get as caregivers, and I think you're completely right. It's well-meaning and well-intended, and yet it almost takes too long to explain why I don't think it would work that way, or why, you know, it just makes for frustrating conversations. So it's really great to have a perspective to share with others, like in, like this, I'm not just making this up. I'm not just being lazy. I'm not just being, you know, overwhelmed in a way that is particular to me. This is common to the caregivers of those with FASD, and having a book like yours is just terrific to have. I can't believe I just had that conversation just yesterday over dinner. So, and it just feels frustrating and adds to the frustration, because you want to have the help that people want to give, but there's just that different perspective and insight that doesn't quite match. So I'm sure you've felt that quite a bit.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to add one more thing, too, something
sure.
that I've ran into, and I think I'm not alone in this. There are people who give advice when they don't know anything that they don't
right.
know what you're talking about. You know, getting rid of, in our case, it didn't work. You know, if you cut sugar out of the diet, you know, your
right.
son's going to be a completely
right, right.
You just need a firmer hand, letting him get away with too much.
Oh, yeah.
Just all this stuff. And I don't even know if it's well-meaning sometimes. I do think that people
give
advice or they think maybe they know what they're talking about. And they think, you know, just give me your child for 1 week and then I'll, you know, everything will be sorted out. And, you know, it's pretty complex. And then there's other people who understand that it's complex. And you know that these are the people that you want to be around. The other ones are toxic to you.
Yes, yes. So how do you handle the toxic people that sort of run into your parenting and family? What do you do when that occurs?
Well, you know what? That's a good question. When Michael was really young, and people had suggestions, just take this vitamin B syrup and everything is going to be hunky-dory. I think I did everything that people suggested because I thought it didn't hurt. And it didn't hurt Michael, but every time I tried something new, my hope would go up, and I would be deflated again. And slowly but surely, I began to realize that, you know, this wasn't just a simple matter. And I also stopped telling people a lot of things because at first I was asking advice, or actually wasn't asking advice, but people provided it anyway. But one of the things that I was really careful about in terms of people being toxic, a lot of people, Michael's life was changed enormously by taking ADHD meds.
Right.
It was the first thing that had a huge positive impact on his life. And we had a wonderful doctor at the Hospital for Sick Children here in Toronto who put Michael through a triple blind study to find out if meds would work and at what dose and so on. I realized, you know, Michael began to do really well once he was on these meds. And I would tell people about it. And there's some people who just don't believe in meds. They don't believe in ADHD. And they would say, why would you want to give meds to your children? Just take away the sugar or do this or that. And I was starting to get really quite angry because they didn't know Michael and they weren't doing anything to help Michael. And we were lucky to find something. I couldn't understand why they weren't happy for us.
Right.
So I was very careful about telling people about Michael's meds because I found that to be a particularly controversial subject. And I'm sure the meds don't work for some kids. And the meds probably are overprescribed. But in Michael's case, they weren't. They worked beautifully. So I began to protect myself more. As Michael got older and I grew older and a little wiser, I began to protect myself, and I knew who I wanted to talk to and knew who I did not want to talk to. And that helped me a lot. It really did.
I think that's really important for caregivers to know, especially those that are just starting out or have just gotten their kid diagnosed or, you know, are suspecting that. It's really just being careful about who you talk to, because you just open yourself up to a lot of, I think you're right. The hope rises and then it falls. And after a while that just really can wear you down and increase, stress, just parenting stress and reactivity and overreactivity even. So,
yeah. Well, another thing too, I don't know if you ran into this, but a lot of people don't believe in getting your child labeled.
Right.
Once the child is labeled, it's going to follow them the rest of their lives and so on. Well, our son was already labeled. He was the bad kid.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, having FASD, if it was going to be a label, was much better than that. And then we knew what to do. Yeah, so again, the whole thing about labeling, I just had to develop a thicker skin and just not listen to people. Getting Michael diagnosed, which included a label, was an important step in our family's life.
Well, in my professional life, I'm in the business of labeling, or that's part of what I do. And you're right. People have concerns and trepidation about that. But if you don't, I mean, you can still do interventions and act as if without the label, but it sure is helpful and you can access more services. There was a study recently done in one of the Scandinavian countries about adoptees with FASD and those without with suspected, and then just the normal group, and the behavior problems and all of that was pretty common in both groups, the diagnosed and undiagnosed group. But the parenting stress reactivity was way higher in the undiagnosed than the diagnosed. So getting that diagnosis is important. And the labeling, you know, people just got to kind of deal with it how they need to deal with it and get the services that they need. So, you know, that brings me to a question I like to ask people is, and this is in your book in some ways, but I'd like to ask people about their origin stories for FASD. Like when did they first hear about FASD and what were their feelings at that moment? Is that something you can speak to?
Yeah. Oh, and I really do talk about it in the book.
Right.
So Michael's now 27. So his diagnosis was quite a long time ago. It was when he was six. And so that was 1993.
Okay.
And at that time, FASD was really under the radar. You know, it's under the radar now still. But people really didn't know much about it then, including me, because Mike and my husband, Michael, was a difficult child from the day we brought him home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lovable. We bonded immediately. There was no question about any of that. But he was irritable and he startled. He just, you know, he was just having trouble being alive. And deep in my heart, I knew something was wrong with Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wasn't growing properly. He wasn't eating properly. We couldn't get him on any sleep cycle. And we had him to many doctors, and they just said, underdeveloped nervous system, or you're not parenting right. You know, you need to have a firmer hand. So the years before he was diagnosed were extremely difficult because we thought, what are we doing wrong? And, you know, how do we help Michael? As he developed these wonderful qualities, and we could see in certain situations and so on, he functioned better than others. But in my heart, I knew something was wrong. But all the doctors were saying, no, he's just a little active boy, and he's going to outgrow it, and so on. He was expelled by the time he hit first grade.
Right.
I finally said to our pediatrician, it's time. We've got to find out what's going on here. So he finally agreed, but he, before that, didn't think we needed a referral. Mm. So when we went to a child development clinic and he was diagnosed with FASD, in some ways it was a relief because it felt like it was the beginning of a time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
It helped my husband and I expiate the guilt that we have for not being able to help Michael.
Right.
And realizing that we weren't the root cause of his problems. So in some way, it sounds odd because you don't want to hear it on the one hand, but in some ways it felt good to have the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Because we believed it could help us move forward. On the other hand, the prognosis at that time it was based on the research at the time, and FASD hadn't been recognized as a syndrome for that long, and a lot of the research was done on populations where the kids hadn't been diagnosed till they were teens. There had not been early intervention or early diagnosis, so the prognosis was really awful. And we were lucky that the doctor at the clinic said to us, don't pay too close attention to the research. You know, you've done a great job so far. Michael has bonded with you. You've loved him. His chances for moving forward in his life are probably better than some of these other children. So it gave us hope. It doesn't mean that we were able to reverse every aspect of the prognosis, because Michael did drop out of school in grade 8. You know, he had all kinds of problems. But there was no doubt that it helped us with the parenting and helped us move forward. So I think that explains, you know, we had mixed feelings about the diagnosis. You know, hearing that your son has irreversible brain damage is not exactly pleasant. On the other hand, it helped us understand what was going on and how we could move forward.
Absolutely. It sort of anchors you in and can point you in the right direction instead of in all the wrong directions.
Really well said.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. So kind of bringing, and you're right, it was very bleak back in the 90s. That's when I started. And there was not very much out there. And it was, it was tough. It was tough to even find people that would diagnose. So to fast forward here to, 2014, maybe you get this question a lot, but I'm wondering, this is a little two-part question maybe. I'm wondering how Michael is doing. I think it's a three-part question. How is Michael doing? How is Michael doing with you and your husband, his family? And then I also noticed, I found that he does wood carvings too. So I was kind of curious about that. So that's my three-part question.
Right. All good questions. Okay, well, as I said, Michael is now 27.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's doing very well considering who Michael is and what his gifts and limitations are. He lives during the week in a group home.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives with us. He comes back to our home on Toronto Island, where we live, on Fridays. And he spends Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays with us, goes back to the group home Sunday evenings. It's good for Michael to have the sense of independence, to be away from us. It's wonderful for him to be able to come back and spend the time with us on the weekends. It's also good for my husband and I. So we're lucky that we were able to find a place for Michael that works well for all of us. He's doing very nicely. As I mentioned, Michael did drop out of school in grade 8. And 2 years ago, he decided he wanted to go back and get a high school equivalency, which is called a GED.
Right.
I'm not sure if it's the same name in the States. And he's been going to school every day, going by himself and taking classes, doing extremely well, and we expect him to get his high school certificate fairly soon.
Mm.
To date, he hasn't been able to hold a job. He still lacks some motivation, ability to follow multi-step tasks. And we're hoping with his GED, we may be able to find some vocational, that the next step will be developing some kind of vocation for him, because he is maturing. He's an extremely lovely, gentle, kind young man. We're very proud of him, and he's become a really nice person. Saying that, he does have his limitations, there's no doubt, and he doesn't function all that great in the world, but as I said, he's a lovely person, very kind heart. About 5-6 years ago, my husband started taking Michael to wood carving classes because he was always whittling. One of the things that Michael does, his hands are always moving and just busy hands. And he always liked to whittle. I think he also liked knives. So knives and sticks go together well for Michael. Anyway, Michael doesn't do anything that he doesn't want to do. And he clearly wanted to do this wood carving. He started taking classes, and he definitely has a gift. He started creating. Well, I'm just going to go back a bit. When he was very young, we noticed he seemed to have some artistic talent. But whereas other children develop their skills through the classroom or special classes or by working on their artwork, Michael didn't have the motivation. He didn't follow through. So he never really developed the skills as other children were developing their skills at the same time.
Right.
But Michael's skills and interest came out with wood carving. He seemed to be motivated. And his teacher was very encouraging. And so Robin, my husband, kept taking Michael to classes. And Michael started carving these very beautiful bas-relief wood carving pieces. And lo and behold, his very first piece won a very major award here in the Canadian Wood Carving Championships. And then he carves animals, And there's a very gentle spirit to them. They're very beautiful, really nicely done. So he won the Canadian Championship in the novice category. He then won the Ontario Wood Carving Championship for another piece. One of them is of a bass swimming upstream. Another one is a bear with a salmon, catching a salmon in his mouth. He's just done a beautiful black bear in the round that he's just finishing right now. So the wonderful thing about the wood carving is that it gives him confidence. It gives him pride. It gives him something to talk about with other people, because people are always saying, Michael, what a wonderful, you know, sculpture this is, and they ask him questions. Right. So he has something constructive and positive to talk about, because he's not that socially adept. So this has just been wonderful, and you know, it would be really nice to think, and I hope it's true, that everybody has a gift of some kind, and, you know, the challenge is to help them find it. And this is clearly Michael's gift.
I would agree completely. I saw some photographs of his on one of your websites, and they were very intricate and well done. And it was just a pleasure to see that. And I think, I've seen that with other folks with FASD, is that there is talent there, and there's just not enough juice to and motivation to go to have special lessons or, you know, practice in a way that other kids might at that early age. Yeah. So it comes along if we don't push too hard, has been my observation, and then it can really blossom, and it's just some beautiful work that he's got. I think. Go ahead.
No, it's really something, and I just wanted to mention that Michael's half brother, who's also on the spectrum, he's become a fabulous guitar player and just a wonderful musician. He's writing songs. So there's another person who, you know, we know in our immediate life who's found their gift as well.
And it just takes some time to do that. That's great. So I'm going to, if it's all right, I'm going to post a link to your website with that on it for folks to check out. And that they can see some of his talent. And also, you know, I'll also put a link to where people can find the book. And your other books, I think, are also listed on some of them. Is there anything, as we draw to a close, is there any kind of final thought you have, Linda, that you'd like to share with folks?
No, I really appreciate the interview, Michael, because it's from somebody who's also a caregiver, and your questions are coming from somebody who really knows what it's like to be a caregiver. So you ask questions that other people wouldn't know to ask, and I do appreciate that. And I hope my book is helpful to other families. And as I say, I'm really hoping some professionals will read it too. So that little empathy thing can develop, in their hearts. And I appreciate you plugging the book. And if people go to my website, there is a link to buy the book just for them to get the photos there so that they can get an idea. If they read the book, what this family I've been talking about really looks like and what we do and all that. So,
well, you're welcome. And I thank you for writing this. And I would really just encourage professionals and caregivers. It's not, you know, sometimes people will see a memoir and, you know, a lot of memoirs will have a lot of emotion, and there is that here too, but there's that connection, and there's that way of being able to recognize the experience. So I think caregivers will really resonate to it and benefit from it. And I think you're right. I think professionals will have a better idea of the struggles and joys that a family has when they're working with someone who has FASD. So I want to encourage folks to go out there and buy that. So where can people find you? Do you want to give a Twitter handle or Facebook page I will definitely put those in the blog too, but how do they get in touch with you if they want to?
I'm Linda Rosenbaum 1 on Twitter.
Okay.
And I have a Facebook page, a professional Facebook page that's Linda Rosenbaum 2, I think it's called.
Okay.
And my website is lindarosenbaum.com, which also can link people to, I have a blog called Much More Than Mom.
Yes.
And so that's another way to get connected. And just to remind people that the name of my book is Not Exactly As Planned, A Memoir of Adoption, Secrets, and Abiding Love.
And it is a great book, and I'm working on it as we speak. Well, not exactly as we speak, but I'm working on it today in my semi-retreat. And it's just been a pleasure speaking with you, Linda. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks again for joining me on the FASD Elephant Podcast. If you have a question, a comment, or some feedback to make this a better podcast, you can email that to me at michael@fasdelephant.com. Remember, I may read your email on the podcast, so if you don't want that, be sure to put a note to that effect in the email. You can also make comments on the blog at www.fasdelephant.com, where you can find show notes, links, and other related information that might be helpful to you. Please remember that the information on this podcast is for a general audience. It is not psychological or medical advice for any particular situation, so be sure to consult with your own mental health or medical provider for your own specific circumstances. Have a great day, and thanks for listening.